August 4th, 1971, Galveston, Texas. After spending the day at the beach, 14-year-old Rhonda Renee Johnson and 13-year-old Sharon Shaw failed to return home and their skeletal remains are found in a bayou months later. A suspect named Michael Lloyd Self is eventually taken into custody and confesses to the murders, but even though he maintains that the confession was coerced and he is innocent, he is still convicted of the crime. Decades later, another convicted murderer named Edward Harold Bell becomes an alternate suspect after he sends confession letters to the authorities. Bell claims he was responsible for the murders of 11 female victims in Texas during the 1970s and refers to them as the 11 who went to heaven. But none of those cases are conclusively solved. After that, the trail went cold.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to a very special milestone for The Trail Went Cold, our 7-year anniversary show. I'm your host, Robin Warder, and to commemorate this special occasion, our podcast will be releasing a 2-part series of episodes, and it will be covering a very convoluted story involving 11 murder victims. This is the saga of the 11 who went to heaven. That voice you just heard narrating our intro was Amy Harbour, the latest winner of our most recent Trail Went Cold listener voiceover contest, so thank you very much, Amy. This is a recurring monthly contest which we've been carrying on for 5.5 years now, so if you'd like to enter and haven't already done so, I will be providing instructions near the end of this episode. Anyway, the 11 murders we'll be profiling in this series of episodes involve female victims between the ages of 12 and 19, and these crimes all took place within the same 3-county area of Texas during the 1970s. The 11 who went to heaven is a phrase which was used by a convicted murderer named Edward Harold Bell, who claimed that he was responsible for killing all these victims. Now, if you're an Unsolved Mysteries fan, you're probably familiar with the name Edward Harold Bell, as he was one of the most memorable wanted fugitives ever profiled on the show. After murdering a man named Larry Dickens in Texas in 1978, Bell spent the next 14 years as a wanted fugitive before he was captured and sent to prison for the crime. But years after his conviction, Bell started sending out confession letters in which he claimed that he was responsible for at least 11 more murders. Bell's claims have been extensively investigated by a retired homicide detective named Fred Page and a journalist named Lisa Olson, whose findings became the subject of a multi-episode true crime series titled The 11, which aired on the A&E Network in 2017. Now, Bell would eventually recant his confessions, but there is circumstantial evidence to suggest that he might have been telling the truth. He did provide a number of accurate details about the crimes, and he was definitely living in that particular area of Texas during the 1970s. We'll be exploring all 11 of these murders through the course of this series, but on today's episode, we're going to focus exclusively on the murders of Rhonda Renee Johnson and Sharon Shaw, because officially, they are not considered to be unsolved. A suspect named Michael Lloyd Self was sent to prison after he confessed to the murders of both girls, but claimed that his confession was coerced by a corrupt police chief who threatened to shoot him if he did not tell him what he wanted to hear. Self never stopped maintaining his innocence, but passed away before Edward Harold Bell popped up on the radar as an alternate suspect. Since Self was never officially exonerated, there is still a lot of controversy surrounding this case and whether or not the right man was convicted, so in this particular episode, we are going to share all the details about these two murders. However, before we get started, just a quick reminder that The Trail Went Cold is a weekly podcast, which is currently available for download on several platforms, including Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, and Spotify. So if you like this podcast, be sure to subscribe to it, and please leave us a rating or review on any of those sites to help spread the word. The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so if you would like to learn how to support the show, please visit our page at patreon.com/thetrailwentcold. For as little as $1 a month, you can garner access to exclusive rewards, which may include stickers and thank you cards, early access to episodes, and bonus content. Also, I just wanted to mention that this coming Saturday, February the 25th at 8 p.m. Eastern Time, I'll be holding another Unsolved Mysteries Live Watch Marathon, in which I'll be screening classic segments from the show, which you can watch alongside myself and your fellow listeners. The link to our screening room is in the show notes, or you can find it pinned at the top of our social media pages. So once again, our Unsolved Mysteries Live Watch takes place this coming Saturday, February the 25th at 8 p.m. Eastern Time, and we hope to see you there. So with all that out of the way, let us now begin our series on the 11 who went to heaven by exploring the murders of Rhonda Renee Johnson and Sharon Shaw. Our first story begins in Texas in 1971, and our first victims are 14-year-old Rhonda Renee Johnson, who goes by the name Renee, and 13-year-old Sharon Lynn Shaw, who was just 1 week shy of her 14th birthday. The two girls were best friends and lived in Webster, a small town located in Harris County next to Interstate 45, which had a population of around 2,200 people at that time. After the girls spent the night together at Renee's house, they woke up on the morning of August the 4th and decided they wanted to travel 25 miles southeast to Galveston, a coastal resort city which is located on Galveston Island next to the Gulf of Mexico. Renee and Sharon were both heavily into water skiing and surfing and hoping to spend the day at the beach, and since one of Renee's neighbors was driving there that morning, he agreed to give them a ride. Renee's father agreed to the request, but told the girls that they needed to be back in time for lunch at 1 p.m., but even though he would not be home at that time, he would still call the house to check and make sure the two girls were there. Since a number of Renee and Sharon's friends were going to be in Galveston that day, they said they would likely hitch a ride home with one of them. After the neighbor drove the two girls to Galveston, he dropped them off at the Wick Ski School, located next to Offutt's Bayou. They were hoping to go water skiing that day, but were told that the ski boat wouldn't be able to go out because the water was too choppy. After leaving the ski school at around 9 a.m., Renee and Sharon soon bumped into a friend of theirs named Glenda Willis, who gave them a ride along Seawall Boulevard. They asked if Glenda would be willing to drive them back to Renee's house in Webster in order to be there in time for the 1 p.m. phone call from Renee's father, but Glenda said that she wanted to stay in Galveston until at least the mid to late afternoon. The two girls then told Glenda they would hitch a ride to Webster with someone else, but after they answered the phone call, they were going to hitchhike back to Galveston for the rest of the afternoon. Glenda proceeded to drop off Renee and Sharon in front of the flagship hotel and told them that if they did return to Galveston, she would meet them at the hotel at 5:30 p.m. and give them a ride back to Webster to spend the evening hanging out at Glenda's house. The two girls then parted ways with Glenda, who said she saw them heading in the direction of the Jericho Surf Shop, but this would turn out to be the last time they were confirmed to be alive. Glenda returned to the flagship hotel at 5:30, but Renee and Sharon did not meet her there, so she just assumed they caught a ride home with someone else. The two girls also did not show up at Glenda's house later that evening. Well, it would turn out that no one answered the phone at Renee's residence when her father attempted to call her at 1 p.m. Neither of the girls returned home that night, so their families eventually became concerned enough to file a missing persons report with the Webster Police Department. Of course, the police initially suspected that the two girls had run away, as they had previously talked about hitchhiking to go surfing in Malibu, and were not looking forward to starting high school the following month. For the next 5 months, no trace of the girls could be found, but on January the 3rd, 1972, two boys were fishing on Taylor Bayou near Clear Lake, a location that was only about 5 miles from Webster, and they came across a large white object floating in the water of a drainage ditch. They initially thought that the object looked like a volleyball, and they told one of their fathers about their discovery when they returned home. They all decided to return to the location the following morning to retrieve the object, and that's when they realized it was a human skull. After the authorities were notified, the skull was turned over to the medical examiner, who believed that it appeared to belong to a young girl. Well, dental records would soon positively identify the skull as belonging to Rhonda Renee Johnson. A search of the area would turn up some additional skeletal remains, which were also believed to be Renee's, but Sharon was still technically missing. It's also worth noting that 4 months earlier, on September 1, 1971, a decomposing torso that was missing its head and limbs had been found in a drainage ditch along Port Road, not far from the location where Renee's skull was discovered. The torso was clad in a t-shirt for the Jericho Surf Shop, but since the medical examiner believed that the victim was male, they were ruled out as being Renee or Sharon. They would tentatively identify the victim as 13-year-old Philip Manning, who had been reported missing in July after running away from his home in Pasadena, Texas, but we'll talk more about him later on. On February 17, 1972, 6 weeks after the discovery of Renee's skull, a second skull and some additional skeletal remains were discovered in a tidal marsh in Taylor Bayou. The location was only about a half mile away from the spot where Renee was found, and dental records would positively identify this skull as belonging to Sharon. A necklace with a crucifix, which Sharon always wore, was found wrapped around her jawbone, and a search of the area would turn up some clothing, which matched the description of what Renee and Sharon had been wearing on the day they vanished. Curiously, a pair of keys were also found at the scene, though they could not be matched up to a specific location. Due to the condition of the remains, the girl's exact cause of death could not be determined. A homicide investigation was launched, and since the remains had been found near Webster, the case would fall under the jurisdiction of the Webster Police Department. There would be a lot of pressure to solve the case, since Renee's grandfather, Roy Johnson, was a prominent city council member who later became the town's mayor. Over the next few months, very little progress was made in the investigation, so after their elections took place in late May, the Webster City Council decided to get rid of the town's current police chief, J.C. Norman, and replaced him with a new police chief, Donald Ray Morris, who worked as a trooper in the traffic division of the Texas Department of Public Safety. Morris then decided to bring in Tommy Lee Deal, who had worked alongside him at the DPS, hiring him as an assistant police chief and putting him in charge of the investigation into Renee and Sharon's murders. Well, shortly after starting the new jobs, Morris and Deal received a tip from a city councilman who recommended they look into a local 23-year-old gas station attendant named Michael Lloyd Self. Nicknamed Slow Mike by members of the community, Self was known for having below-average intelligence due to brain damage he had suffered as a child, and he also had a spotty employment record. He was considered to be a law enforcement hanger-on who made friends with a number of the local police officers, including the former police chief J.C. Norman, and he often liked to chat with them about cases in the news. In 1970, Self had been arrested on two separate occasions for Peeping Tom incidents in nearby League City, though he was never actually convicted of either of these offenses and agreed to court-ordered psychiatric treatment instead. It turned out that Don Morris had a prior history with Self, as he had once worked as a security guard at the apartment complex where Self lived. There were incidents where Morris accused Self of looking up girls' dresses as they walked up the stairs, and at one point, he accused Self of stealing gasoline from a station wagon belonging to the chief of the Webster Fire Department, where Self had been a volunteer firefighter. After Tommy Deal received a tip that Self had marijuana in his apartment, the police performed a search of it, and they proceeded to find some bags of weed under Self's mattress, as well as a large quantity of pornographic magazines and photos inside his closet. Self was taken to the police station for questioning about the marijuana, and tried to claim that he had no idea how the marijuana wound up in his apartment. Deal used this opportunity to ask Self about his previous arrests for being a peeping Tom, and Self said that he had been overcome with a compulsion to trail some girls home and spy on them through their bedroom windows as they undressed. Deal ultimately told Self that he would not be charged with marijuana possession and let him go, but he was already looking at him as a potential suspect in Renee and Sharon's murders. After performing a background check on Self, Deal learned that he had gotten divorced from his wife the previous year after she accused him of going into bouts of rage and beating her. Deal also spoke to a former girlfriend of Self's who had broken up with him a few weeks earlier, and she recounted a bizarre incident where Self suddenly grabbed her while she was walking home and asked, quote, "What would you do if you knew I was the man who killed Renee Johnson and Sharon Shaw?" On the morning of June 9th, Self was in the midst of working the overnight shift as an attendant at a local gas station when Deal and another Webster police officer named Herman Morgan decided to pay him a visit there at 5 a.m. Deal made a comment about how he had ESP and could tell that Self was thinking about two girls. Even though Deal was obviously referring to Renee and Sharon, Self would later say that he thought Deal had been referring to his ex-wife and a new girlfriend he had started dating. Deal then asked Self if he would stop by the police station after his shift ended in order to answer a few questions, and Self agreed. Self arrived at the station shortly after 7 a.m., and after agreeing to waive his constitutional rights, he was taken into the interrogation room to be questioned about the murders of Renee and Sharon. Within the next 2 hours, Self supposedly admitted to the crime and signed a written confession. Now, details of this confession would soon change, but here's the first version of events that Self provided. He initially claimed that on the evening of August the 4th, 1971, he picked up Renee outside the Clear Lake Theater in Webster after telling her he had some grass and pills. They then proceeded to head to Sharon's house and picked her up there before driving to the nearby town of Seabrook. Self said he gave the girls some grass as they were riding around, and Renee and Sharon proceeded to start hollering out the window, so he told them to stop for fear that they might be pulled over. At around 10:45 p.m., Self was driving through the town of Alago, but he said that the two girls would not stop hanging out the window and hollering at everyone they passed by. By this point, Self said that he had taken a lot of nerve pills and was very wound up, so he drove to a remote area and told the girls he was going to do something he didn't want to do. After stopping the car, Self told Renee and Sharon that he was going to beat them to death because they were going to get him into trouble. He pulled the two girls out of the vehicle and walked them down to the lake, and then said he tried to force himself on Renee. When Sharon tried to intervene, Self hit her with his fist and kicked Renee, but both girls attempted to run away. Self managed to catch up with them, beating Sharon to death by punching her in the face several times and strangling Renee until she quit moving. Self then placed the girls' bodies inside a culvert by the road and covered them up with tree limbs before he drove away. After Self was charged with capital murder, he was transferred to the Harris County Jail in Houston and assigned a court-appointed public defender named Dewey Meadows. To Meadows' surprise, Self recanted his confession, claiming that it had been coerced from him by Chief Don Morris and that he was completely innocent of the crime. According to Self, when he first arrived at the police station, Deal showed him photographs of Renee and Sharon and was asked if he knew them. Self acknowledged that he recognized their photos from the newspaper coverage of the murders, but claimed that he did not know either of them personally. In spite of this response, Self said that the officers handcuffed him and brought him into the interrogation room. Deal then told him that they had evidence connecting him to the murders, even though Self denied any involvement. Chief Morris eventually took charge of the investigation, and Deal left the room. In his original account, Self said that two other Webster police officers, Herman Morgan and Jerry Mitchell, were in the room alongside Morris while the following events took place, but he later changed his story and said that Morris was alone. Morris accused Self of murdering Renee and Sharon, and even though Self continued to deny it, Morris told him that he would not be allowed to leave until he made a full confession. Things escalated to the point where Morris held Self against a wall and repeatedly poked him in the stomach with his nightstick before hitting him in the back and shoulders a few times. When Self still refused to confess, Morris then pulled out his gun, emptied out 5 bullets, and placed them all on the table. With 1 bullet apparently still inside, Morris spun the gun's chamber around as if he was preparing to play a game of Russian roulette. He then pointed the gun at Self's head and threatened to shoot him if he did not confess, so Self finally agreed. Self claimed that he was told to produce a handwritten confession and that Morris forced him to rewrite it several times. Once they had a version of the confession that Morris was satisfied with, he made Self sign it. Well, 3 days after he was charged with murder, things got even more complicated when Self agreed to be questioned at the Harris County Jail by a number of officers from different law enforcement agencies. He also consented to a polygraph exam, even though his attorney, Dewey Meadows, advised him against it and told Self that he should not speak to the police without him being present. It turned out the questioning was related to the unsolved murders of a number of other teenage girls, which had taken place in Galveston, Harris, and Brazoria counties over the past year, and we'll be talking about these crimes in more detail on our next episode. Self never admitted any culpability in these other murders and was not considered to be a suspect. However, the polygraph test would provide some interesting results, because when Self was asked if his original confession to the crime had been true, the results indicated deception, leading the polygraph examiner to believe that the confession was not legitimate. So following his interrogation, Self wound up signing a second written confession to Renee and Sharon's murders. Self told his attorney that he only did so because he was still afraid of Chief Morris, and had been told that he would feel better and be allowed to see his mother if he cooperated, but Self still maintained that both confessions were false. It turned out this second confession was a revised version of the first one, and that a number of details have been added or changed. One of the biggest holes in Self's original confession is that he claimed he had picked up Sharon from her house, but Sharon's family confirmed that she never returned home at any point that evening. So in his second confession, Self claimed that he picked up Renee while she was walking down the road on El Camino Real, and she asked him to drive her to the Nassau Bay Yacht Club, which is where they picked up Sharon. The two girls told Self that they had been at the beach in Galveston earlier that day, and were going to get into trouble with their parents for not returning home when they were supposed to, which is why they were hoping to concoct a story to explain their absence. Self then shared the same account of them smoking grass in the car, and him getting angry about the girls hanging out the window and hollering at people, though he also added that in addition to having taken several nerve pills, he drank about 8 to 10 beers. They eventually drove into a remote area and stopped at the side of Old Red Bluff Road, where Self once again claimed that he attempted to force himself onto Renee, though this time, the assault took place inside the car instead of outside near a lake. When Renee fought him off and climbed out of the vehicle, Self now said that he grabbed a Coke bottle from the floorboard of the back seat and hit Sharon in the head with it multiple times before she fell to the ground. Even though Renee tried to run away, Self managed to catch up with her and drag her back to the car, where he repeatedly hit her with the Coke bottle. Interestingly enough, even though Self claimed that he fatally choked Renee during his original confession, there was no mention of strangulation this time around. While her exact cause of death could not be determined, the medical examiner did confirm that Renee's neck bones show no signs of damage to suggest that strangulation or choking had taken place. But on the other hand, it did not look like either the girl's skulls were fractured to back up Self's story that he hit them with a Coke bottle. Self said that he proceeded to drive to Taylor Bayou and dumped the two girls' bodies into the water before covering them up with old grass and tree limbs. This was a particularly important revision because in his previous confession, Self never mentioned driving the bodies to another location, only that he killed the girls at a lake near El Lago and placed them in a culvert. This almost seemed to indicate that Self had gotten Taylor Bayou mixed up with Taylor Lake, which was located a few miles away. Another new detail in this confession is that Self now said that he stripped off the girls' clothing and tossed each piece one by one into ditches on both sides of Old Red Bluff Road while he was driving away. Even though Self's second confession fixed some of the holes in his first confession, there were still some troubling inconsistencies. For starters, Self's new detail about tossing each piece of the girls' clothing into various ditches while driving away did not ring true, since their clothes had been found in the bayou in close proximity to Sharon's remains. We'll talk more about him in a few moments, but the original lead investigator on the case was a Webster police officer named Dave Coburn. Even though Self claimed that Renee and Sharon had been hanging out the window and hollering at people while he drove them around, Coburn said that he was unable to find one witness who could corroborate this story and recalled seeing the two girls inside Self's car that night. Coburn also said that he took sworn statements from two other girls who knew Renee and Sharon personally and maintained that they had spoken to them in Galveston between 8 and 9 p.m. on the night they went missing. If the recollection was accurate, then this seemed to contradict Self's story about picking up the girls at around 9 p.m. in Webster, which was 25 miles away. Now, getting back to Dave Coburn, he had been the lead investigator for the Webster PD under the previous police chief, J.C. Norman, but after Morris and Deal were brought in to replace him, Coburn resigned from the force. By the time Self was arrested, Coburn had become the chief of police in the town of Cleveland, Texas, but he decided to pay Self a visit in jail. Self once again shared his story about Morris removing bullets from his handgun and placing them in front of him and threatening to play Russian roulette with the one remaining bullet unless Self confessed. Well, upon hearing this, Coburn told Self that 1 year earlier, he had personally witnessed Morris do the exact same thing to another prisoner. Self's story also seemed to be backed up by a Webster police officer named Jerry Mitchell, who knew Self personally and was present when Self was brought into the interrogation room to be questioned by Tommy Deal about the murders. Mitchell claimed that Self did not appear to be nervous, and when Morris stepped in to take over the investigation, Mitchell left the room. However, when Mitchell returned to the room less than 1 hour later, he said that Self was shaken and upset. Mitchell then witnessed Self writing out his confession on a piece of paper before Morris crumpled it up and told Self to rewrite it. Mitchell and another Webster police officer would also give sworn statements that they had witnessed Morris abuse other prisoners. In spite of these revelations, Self would still go on trial in May of 1973, but the state made a calculated decision to only try him for Sharon's murder. If Self was acquitted of the crime, this left open the option to bring him to trial again for Renee's murder. The case would be prosecuted by George Karam, who would rely heavily on Self's confessions since there was no physical evidence tying him to the murder. Self's defense attorney, Dewey Meadows, who was inexperienced and had never tried a murder case before, attempted to prevent the confessions from being entered into evidence at the trial. He maintained that the confessions had been coerced and that Self simply told the police what they wanted to hear, as psychiatrists would describe him as, quote-unquote, weak-willed, very insecure, easily led, and easily intimidated. A hearing was held about this issue without the jury being present, and the court ruled that both of Self's confessions had been given voluntarily and were admissible. In the end, Self's first written confession was not admitted into evidence for the trial, but his second written confession, which he made 3 days after he was charged, would be. But the defense was taken by surprise when the state introduced a so-called third confession from Self into evidence. 2 weeks after he was arrested, Self was visited in jail by a Harris County Sheriff's deputy named Hank Bamer, who claimed that Self once again confessed to the murders. Bamer said that Self agreed to show him the locations where the crime took place, so the following evening, Bamer and another sheriff's deputy named W.A. Turner checked Self out of the county jail and took him out and bought him some food. Afterward, Self directed the two deputies to all the locations where he had picked up the two girls, drove them around, killed them, and dumped their bodies. They took photographs of Self at all these places, including a Sizzler steakhouse, as he now claimed this was where he originally picked up Renee. Self was also photographed on the road, where he said he undressed Renee and Sharon's dead bodies, carried their bodies across a guardrail, and threw them into Taylor Bayou near a culvert, which turned out to be the exact spot where Sharon's skeletal remains were ultimately found. There were photos of Self gesturing at this spot, but he told Meadows that he was only doing what the deputies were instructing him to do. However, Deputy Bamer testified that he hadn't even read Self's previous confessions before this trip took place, and maintained that Self willingly led them to these locations without any guidance. He also claimed that Self had been advised of his rights prior to the trip and never requested his attorney. In addition, Self had also supposedly directed the authorities to the location where he dumped the bodies shortly after he was charged with murder and taken to the police station in La Porte on June the 9th, 1972. Self took the stand to testify on his own behalf and admitted that he made the confession of his own free will, but he only did so because he feared that Don Morris would kill him, and that all the information he shared with law enforcement was taken from newspaper accounts about the case. For their part, Morris and Tommy Deal testified that before Self signed his first written confession, they took him in front of a judge who advised Self of his constitutional privileges and appointed him an attorney, but Self never attempted to recant his story. The prosecution produced some nude photos of Self, which had been taken at another police station in the town of La Porte shortly after he was charged with murder, and they showed no marks or bruises on his body to support his story that he had been physically abused by Morris. Self's explanation was that he did not bruise easily, but while he was being examined at the hospital, he never told the doctor that he was beaten or threatened. Following the examination, Self was taken to the Harris County Jail, where a sheriff's deputy asked him if he had been abused, threatened, or mistreated by the Webster PD, and Self replied, no. Even though South claimed that he made a second confession because he was afraid of Morris, Deal testified that Morris was not present when this confession was written, and that he advised Self of his rights without any coercion and intimidation, and Self did not request his attorney before he agreed to sign it. As far as other evidence, the prosecution presented a witness who said he had seen Self talking to Renee and Sharon outside a convenience store, and it does not sound like Self was able to offer a solid alibi to account for his whereabouts on the night the girls were murdered. Self would be the only witness produced by the defense, as Dewey Meadows believed that the case against his client was so weak that he was certain of an acquittal. Even though Dave Coburn said that he would be willing to testify about the previous incident where Morris threatened another prisoner with his gun, he was never called upon as a witness. It turned out that Coburn had some credibility issues, as he was known for being a heavy drinker during his time on the Webster PD, and both he and the previous police chief, J.C. Norman, had been accused of displaying brutality towards prisoners. In fact, one of the reasons that Morris was supposedly appointed chief of police was to improve the department's image, which had suffered under the leadership of Norman and Coburn. The case finally went to the jury, and on May the 15th, after deliberating for a total of 13 hours, the jury found Self guilty of Sharon's murder. Self could have received the death penalty, but 1 month before the trial, the United States Supreme Court had ruled it to be unconstitutional and put a temporary moratorium on executions, so he instead received a sentence of life imprisonment. Even though a second indictment was later handed down, which charged Self with Renee's murder, it was later dismissed. Self's defense team filed a motion to appeal his conviction, which wound up getting denied, but within the next few years, there would be a surprising development which cast some serious credibility issues on the individuals who put Self away. In the year following Self's trial, Don Morris and Tommy Deal both left the Webster Police Department. Morris returned to the Texas Department of Public Safety, while Deal left law enforcement altogether and started managing a sporting goods store. Well, on September the 17th, 1975, Deal and another former Webster police officer named George Marshall, who was now working as a Dallas County deputy sheriff, made an attempt to rob the State National Bank in the town of Caddo Mills. The robbery ended with both men taking a teller hostage, who just happened to be the bank president's daughter, but when they fled the scene, an armed posse of 25 of the town's citizens pursued them on an 8-mile chase. The whole thing ended when the town mayor shot out the tires on the robber's vehicle, and Deal and Marshall were both apprehended and turned over to the police. Both men were charged with kidnapping and aggravated robbery, and it turned out they were part of an organized gang which had been robbing banks for years, and their ringleader was none other than Don Morris. In fact, on the day of the robbery, Morris had placed a phone call to the Hunt County Sheriff's Office to falsely report an accident and divert them away from Caddo Mills. He also attempted to assist Deal and Marshall's escape by running one of the vehicles which had been pursuing them off the road. After they were convicted for their various crimes, Morris received a prison sentence of 55 years, while Deal received 30 years. Both men were eventually paroled, though Deal wound up getting indicted again by a federal grand jury for a series of bank robberies which took place in Houston during the summer of 1990. He is currently serving a life sentence at a federal prison in Minnesota. Naturally, these developments only added fuel to the fire over the allegations that Morris and Deal had coerced Self into making a false confession. Another surprising event took place on April the 2nd, 1980, when a man named Patrick Heffernan came forward and confessed that he was responsible for the murders of Renee and Sharon. Heffernan lived in Taylor Lake Village, located only 6 miles away from Webster, and he shared his story during a meeting with the Lakeview Police Department, the original trial prosecutor George Karam, and another prosecutor named Doug O'Brien, who was representing the state during Self's appeals process. Heffernan claimed that he personally knew Renee and Sharon, and had even lived in the same apartment complex as one of them. His confession was described as being vague and disjointed, and Heffernan did not share many specific details. O'Brien would later say that it almost sounded like Heffernan wanted to get something off his chest, but would not provide enough information about the crime for him to face prosecution. However, Heffernan did mention that he had tied the two victims' feet with a black cord And even though a black cord had been found near the remains, this detail was never released publicly, and Self never mentioned it during any of his own confessions. In spite of this, Heffernan was known for being a troubled person who supposedly suffered from psychosis, so the authorities ultimately dismissed his confession as unreliable, and Self's attempts to appeal his conviction would continue to be denied. But even though he was representing the state, O'Brien would eventually come to believe that Self was an innocent man who had been wrongly convicted, and agreed to say so on camera when he was interviewed on Unsolved Mysteries years later. In August of 1990, Self's appeals would finally meet with success when a federal magistrate named George Kelt recommended that Self's conviction be overturned. He believed that Self had been illegally arrested and interrogated, was poorly represented at his trial, and there was no physical evidence against him. In a later interview, Judge Kelt also stated that he did not find it incriminating that Self had supposedly led sheriff's deputies to the spot where the victim's remains were found, as that information was widely circulated by the media at that time. Since the murders had been a pretty huge story, Kelt believed that pretty much the entire community knew where the spot was. After the Texas Attorney General's office appealed Kelt's ruling, U.S. District Judge David Hittner decided to overturn Self's conviction and ordered the state to either retry him or set him free within 90 days. Judge Hittner even stipulated that if the state elected to retry Self, they could not use his confessions as evidence. Self could have potentially walked out of prison in March of 1991, but before this could take place, the case, Arizona versus Fulminante, was heard in front of the United States Supreme Court. It involved a defendant who had been sentenced to death for murder on the basis of a supposedly coerced confession, but by a 5-4 vote, the Supreme Court ruled that defendants were not necessarily entitled to a new trial if their coerced confessions were used as evidence against them, and that the harmless error rule could be applied if the other evidence presented at trial was sufficient enough to convict the defendant. A 3-judge panel from the 5th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals subsequently ruled to indefinitely block Self's release, since they felt the Supreme Court's decision had changed the relevant standard of review in Self's case. In September of 1992, they ruled to uphold Self's conviction. Self's defense team attempted to appeal his conviction all the way to the United States Supreme Court, but on March the 30th, 1993, they refused to consider his request for a new trial, meaning that Self had officially exhausted all of his appeals. Well, on May the 19th of that year, only 7 weeks after the Supreme Court's decision, this story would receive nationwide exposure when it was profiled as a final appeal segment on an episode of Unsolved Mysteries. Even though the segment continued to explore the possibility that Self had been wrongly convicted, it failed to bring about any new leads or developments in the case. In 1995, Self became eligible for parole, and his attorneys informed him that if he admitted his guilt and expressed remorse for his actions in front of the parole board, there was a good chance he could be released. But Self refused to do so and continued to maintain that he did not commit the murders. On December the 21st, 2000, Michael Lloyd Self died of a heart attack at the age of 52 after having spent the last 28 years of his life behind bars. In a cruel twist of fate, and the years following Self's death, Texas appeals courts would rule that a defendant's confession was not sufficient enough for a conviction, and there had to be additional corroborating evidence to support it, but by this point, it was too late to be of any assistance to Self. But there's one more odd postscript to this story that I would like to share. Remember how I mentioned that in September of 1971, the decomposed torso of a young male was discovered in a drainage ditch in close proximity to where Renee's skull would be found? It was initially believed that the torso belonged to a 13-year-old runaway named Philip Manning, but guess what? In 2008, the authorities discovered that Philip Manning was actually alive and well. It turned out that when Philip ran away from home in 1971, he hooked up with a truck driver who made him his apprentice and traveled with him for the next few months. But since the truck driver was abusive, Philip decided to break away from him and join the army. Even though Philip was only 14 years old at that point, he lied about his age and enlisted under a fake name, but when his real identity was uncovered a short time later, he wound up being discharged and sent home. It appears that no one in law enforcement ever found out about this because when investigators reopened the case over 3 decades later, they managed to track down Philip, who was now 49 years old and living in Austin. Of course, since the torso was heavily decomposed, it has now been theorized that the medical examiner may have been mistaken when he identified the victim as male, and that perhaps it actually belonged to Renee all along. Unfortunately, even though investigators were hoping to exhume the torso for DNA testing, it now appears that its current burial site cannot be located. Now, this is ordinarily the point where I would be uttering the phrase, "the trail went cold," but there is a lot more to this story. Michael Lloyd Self's conviction continues to be surrounded with controversy, and I'll be sharing my personal thoughts about his guilt or innocence on my next episode. But at the time he passed away, I don't think Self had any idea that another convicted murderer had already started sending out confession letters to suggest that he may have been the real killer of Rhonda Renee Johnson and Sharon Shaw. And in a stunning twist of fate, it turned out this murderer had been profiled on an entirely different episode of Unsolved Mysteries only 5 months before they featured this case. So if you're a fan of Unsolved Mysteries, you probably know that before he became famous, Academy Award-winning actor Matthew McConaughey got his first major acting role when he portrayed a murder victim in a reenactment from one of the show's segments. This segment has often been cited as one of the most harrowing crimes ever featured on the show, but at the time it was filmed, I'm not sure anyone anticipated that the story might have a potential connection to the murders of Rhonda Renee Johnson and Sharon Shaw. The victim in this case was 26-year-old Larry Dickens, a former Marine and youth counselor who was senselessly shot to death on August 24, 1978. That day, Larry and his 3-year-old daughter Wendy went to pay a visit to his mother, Dorothy Lang, who lived in a suburban neighborhood in Pasadena, Texas. While Larry was mowing the lawn and Wendy was playing outside on her tricycle, a pickup truck pulled up across the street from Dorothy's house, and 39-year-old Edward Harold Bell emerged from the cab. He was nude from the waist down, and after he approached a group of children playing in the street at an intersection, he proceeded to start masturbating in front of them. When Dorothy saw this from her kitchen window, she immediately picked up the phone to call the police and was placed on hold by the operator. Larry soon walked into the kitchen and saw Bell through the window, so he told Dorothy that he would not let Bell leave until the police arrived. After making sure that his daughter was safely back inside the house, Larry walked across the street towards Bell's truck. Since Bell had left his keys in the ignition, Larry grabbed them to prevent Bell from driving away. After Bell put his pants back on, he pulled out a .22 caliber pistol and pointed it at Larry, demanding that he give him back the keys. Larry refused to do so and slowly backed towards his mother's house, so Bell fired a warning shot into the air. When Larry still would not return the keys, Bell proceeded to shoot him a total of 4 times, once in the back, once in the right thigh, and once into each elbow. Dorothy had to witness this horrifying event through the window, so when Larry staggered back into the garage, she went there to help him. By this point, Larry was seriously wounded, and Bell was holding his gun over him, so Dorothy took the keys from her son's hand and gave them back to Bell, advising him to leave because the police were on their way. However, Bell responded by shooting Larry in the cheek, and even though he had 5 bullets in him by this point, Larry still attempted to go after Bell and stop him, but he collapsed onto the driveway. Dorothy went back inside to call an ambulance, but when she returned to the kitchen, she could see Bell grabbing a rifle from his truck. He then walked back to the driveway and fired 1 final shot down into Larry's forehead before he returned to his truck. At this point, Larry's 17-year-old sister Donna was driving home from cheerleader practice, and she witnessed Bell fire the shot. Unaware of what was going on, Donna attempted to cut her car in front of Bell's truck to prevent him from leaving. But once she noticed Larry's body in the driveway, she climbed out of her vehicle to run over and help him, and Bell managed to flee the scene by driving away in reverse. When paramedics arrived at the residence, Larry was pronounced dead at the scene. A police car and a motorcycle cop both responded to the emergency call, and by the time they arrived in the neighborhood, they immediately recognized Bell's truck from the description that was radioed to them. They proceeded to pursue the truck until Bell turned down a dead-end cul-de-sac and found himself cornered. Even though Bell exited the truck and attempted to fire off his rifle, it suddenly jammed, so when the police stopped and pulled out their guns, Bell dropped his rifle and surrendered. He was placed under arrest and taken into custody, and when Bell was driven back to the murder scene, Dorothy and Donna positively identified him as Larry's killer. A check was performed into Bell's background, and during the early stages of his life, he did not seem to be a likely candidate to commit a crime like this, as he had graduated from Texas A&M University, gotten married and had three children, and enjoyed a successful business career. However, Bell obviously had a much darker side, as starting in 1969, he would be arrested no less than 7 times for sex offenses, including exposing himself and masturbating in front of children in both Texas and Louisiana. But Bell was never actually convicted of any of these offenses or spent any time in prison, as he would always have the charges dropped in exchange for entering court-ordered sex offender treatment. Bell's first wife wound up divorcing him, and he was forbidden from having any contact with his children, but in 1970, he got remarried to a female psychiatric patient he had met while undergoing sex offender treatment, even though she was only 17 years old and Bell was 31 at the time. According to those who knew him, Bell often liked to brag that he could talk his way out of anything, and those words continued to ring true after he was charged with Larry Dickens' murder. To everyone's shock, Bell was released on a $40,000 bond the following day in order to undergo psychiatric treatment. The community was so outraged that they wound up storming the courthouse, so this convinced the authorities to bring Bell back into court, where his bond was increased to $125,000. But Bell still managed to pay it and was allowed to remain free while he awaited trial, which was scheduled to begin on January 8, 1979. To no one's surprise, Bell did not show up to court that day, and it turned out that he had spent the past few months liquidating most of his assets, which included all but one of his boats. This boat was discovered to be missing alongside Bell, so it seemed apparent that he had used it to flee the country with over $140,000 in cash in his possession. Over the next several years, the authorities failed to find any trace of Bell, so when the Texas Governor's Office put together a Texas Most Wanted list for fugitives in January of 1985, Bell's name was added to the top of the list. I should mention that the Unsolved Mystery segment contains a reenactment where a woman recounts how a man broke into her home in Bryan, Texas in September of 1984 and tried to attack her in her upstairs bedroom with a hunting knife. The woman proceeded to grab a gun from her nightstand and fired off several shots at the intruder, prompting him to rush downstairs, exit the house, and flee the scene in a truck. Months later, the woman saw Bell's photograph in the newspaper on the Texas Most Wanted list and became convinced he was the same man who had attacked her. However, as far as I can tell, it's never been conclusively verified if it was him, as it would turn out that Bell spent the 1980s hiding out in such places as Mexico, Costa Rica, and Panama. I'm not so sure if Bell would have taken the risk of returning to Texas in order to attack a random woman inside her house, so it's possible that the intruder was a completely different man whom she mistook for Bell. Whatever the case, Bell managed to elude justice for 14 years until Unsolved Mysteries profiled him as a wanted fugitive on the aforementioned episode, which aired on December 2nd, 1992. Immediately after the episode aired, a viewer from Odessa, Texas, contacted the authorities to say that he recognized Bell as a man he had recently leased a boat from in Panama City. Shortly thereafter, the Harris County District Attorney's Office received an anonymous letter from another viewer who had watched the Unsolved Mysteries broadcast and confirmed that Bell had spent the past 10 years living in Panama under the pseudonym Cecil Boyd, which also happened to be the name of a deceased cousin of Bell's, and he usually went by the nickname Wally. Bell had since remarried and was currently living with his third wife, Bernadina Ramirez, who was only 18 years old. The letter writer also enclosed some recent photos of Bell to lend credence to their story, so the American authorities started coordinating with the Panamanian National Police. It was confirmed that Bell and his wife were living on a houseboat at the Pedro Miguel Boat Club in Panama City, so the National Police arrested him there and took him into custody on the morning of February 14, 1993. 4 days later, Bell was extradited back to the United States, and when he finally went on trial for Larry Dickens' murder in June of that year, I'm sure it will not surprise you to learn that he didn't have much of a case. Bell's defense team tried to argue that the shooting was done in self-defense because Larry was a mentally unstable religious fanatic who threatened to kill Bell in the quote-unquote name of Jesus and hit him so hard that he burst his eardrum. Oh, and the fatal shot fired from Bell's rifle down into Larry's forehead was just an unfortunate accident which occurred when Bell tripped and the gun accidentally went off. Well, the jury didn't buy this at all, so on June the 28th, they found Bell guilty of Larry's murder. Before sentencing, Bell actually had the audacity to make this statement, quote, "I know if I hadn't had the problem of being a flasher, I wouldn't have been on that street. I finally got rid of it in Panama, but it was too late for Mr. Dickens." End quote. Yeah, sure, place all the blame on the guy who had the nerve to stop you from exposing yourself to children. Bell wound up receiving a 70-year prison sentence with no possibility of parole for 20 years. Larry's daughter Wendy, who was 18 years old by this point, was present at the trial to witness Bell's conviction and stated, quote, "I've been waiting for this moment for years. I've been waiting for them to say, we find you guilty," end quote. Well, it seemed like the saga of Edward Harold Bell had finally come to an end, but it turned out that it was only just getting started. In 2005, Fred Page, a homicide detective from the Galveston Police Department, started looking into a bunch of unsolved murders which had taken place in the Galveston area during the 1970s and discovered a surprising link to Bell. It turned out that in 1998, Bell had sent letters to prosecutors in Galveston County and Harris County claiming that he was responsible for murdering 7 girls in their respective counties between 1971 and 1977. Galveston County investigators did make an attempt to look into Bell's claims, but when they tried to interview him in prison to ask follow-up questions, he refused to cooperate. Prosecutors ultimately decided not to present Bell's letters to a grand jury because no corroborating evidence could be found to support his confessions, and by this point, Texas law required additional evidence besides a confession in order to indict someone. And one of the biggest issues is that a lot of the original pieces of evidence from these cases had since gone missing, so there was nothing to extract DNA from in order to make a potential comparison to Bell. As far as Harris County goes, their prosecutor said they had misplaced Bell's letters and never even looked into any of his claims. For years, most people were not even aware these confession letters existed until Fred Page finally decided to go public with them in 2011. Even though Bell did not reveal any exclusive details about the crimes in his letters, which were not already public knowledge, the issue is that Bell would not have had access to the internet or old newspaper archives inside prison. Many of the details Bell shared were accurate, and it seems surprising that he could vividly recall murders which took place decades earlier if he did not have some inside knowledge. Page was hoping that by making Bell's claims public, it might encourage people to come forward with information or provide investigators with new leads that could help verify his confessions. After turning down interview requests for several years, Bell finally agreed to have 2 separate meetings with Lisa Olson, an investigative reporter for the Houston Chronicle, and she would publish an article about her findings in September of 2011. However, even though Bell had written in his original confession letters that he was responsible for murdering 7 girls in Texas during the 1970s, he now claimed that the correct total was 11. In fact, he referred to these girls as the 11 who went to heaven. We'll share more details about these victims in our next episode, but Bell said he could only remember the names of 4 of the girls he killed: Debbie Ackerman and Maria Johnson, who were murdered together, Colette Wilson, and another girl named Pitchford, who was likely Kimberly Pitchford. Of the remaining 7 victims, Bell claimed that he killed 3 of them individually, but the other 4 girls were each murdered in pairs. But most intriguingly, Bell said that one of these pairs of girls was from Webster, leading to speculation that he was referring to Rhonda Renee Johnson and Sharon Shaw. And I'm sorry, folks, I think I'm going to have to bring this episode to a close and leave you on a cliffhanger. Be sure to join us next week, as I'll be discussing the other 9 unsolved murders that Edward Harold Bell confessed to and his possible involvement in the Johnson-Shaw case as we continue our series on the 11 who went to heaven. Anyway, another special thanks to listener Amy Harbour for narrating the opening of this week's episode. If you've already entered our listener voiceover contest before, you are automatically eligible for our next random drawing, so you don't have to do anything. But if you would like to enter and haven't already done so, all you have to do is send me an email under the subject line, Trail Went Cold Contest, naming the one unsolved cold case you would most like to see featured on this podcast. Once again, send me an email under the subject line, Trail Went Cold Contest, to robin.warder@icloud.com. That's robin.warder@icloud.com. Now the reminder that The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so please visit patreon.com/thetrailwentcold to learn how you can support our podcast and become eligible for some pretty neat rewards. This past month, we released a bonus episode about a fraud case from Unsolved Mysteries involving a man named Woody Kelly, who embezzled millions of dollars from his clients before he vanished without a trace, and he has not been seen for nearly 38 years. I've also dropped an exclusive bonus episode from my spin-off podcast, The Path Went Chilly, in which myself and my two co-hosts, Jules and Ashley, discuss another case from Unsolved Mysteries, the 1992 murder of Heather Uffelman by an individual known only as Tom Johnson. And for our patrons in Tier 3, I've recorded another new audio commentary track, which can be played over a classic episode of Unsolved Mysteries. I'd also like to give a shout-out to our most recent listeners who have signed up with us on Patreon this week, and they are Ruth A., Big Dave, Diana S., and Sean T. Thank you all so much for your support. I just wanted to give another shout-out to my supporters at the Unsolved Mysteries message board at the Sitcoms Online forum and the Unresolved Mysteries subreddit. I need to provide a big thanks to Miguel Foote, who edits and assembles this podcast together for me, and Vince Nitro, who composes the eerie music you hear on every episode. If you haven't already, you can like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, or leave us a rating or review on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, or Spotify. So have yourself a good week and join us next Wednesday for part two of our special anniversary series about the 11 who went to heaven on the trail went cold. Thank you.